Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. Welcome to WDEV at Radio Vermont. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis. Well, Ray Guy died. 72 years old, the greatest punter in the history of the NFL. I grew up watching him. He was the Roger Federer of football. Not only was he the great player, but he was a beautiful player, a great athlete all around. Drafted by Major League Baseball four times, but decided to want to make a career as a punter in the NFL. You know who also died? Sorry for the noise, I'm leafing through. Florence Miles died. Florence Miles died on her 100th birthday. She was a dairy farmer in Huntington. She milked cows. She came here from Wisconsin, got married, came here after the war, raised a family, and did all the chores, made all the meals. And you can read her obituary in 7 days this week. It is long, and it is substantive, and it's really interesting. So check out Florence Miles. We are 4 days out from an election with enormous implications for our national politics. Will Republicans take control of the U.S. House and Senate, rendering Joe Biden's agenda mute and setting up showdowns over contentious issues like the debt ceiling? And in Vermont, thousands have already voted. Senator Leahy is retiring. Bernie Sanders is, well, Bernie Sanders. And Congressman Peter Welch is favored to take Leahy's seat. And Becca Ballant of Brattleboro, Vermont, is poised to make history as the first woman, and the first gay woman at that, to represent Vermont in the House of Representatives. We will get to it all as much as we can this morning with Mr. Democracy himself, Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos, the state's chief election official. We will hear from him about who is voting, who has voted, how you can vote between now and Tuesday, and everything in between. We will also hear today from 7 Days reporters about their cover story this week about gun violence in the Queen City. And we'll spend some time with our Washington correspondent, Bob Ney, about what's going on down there. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. We welcome your calls, 244-1777, and your emails at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And now, the guy with the job that is supposed to be boring, who makes sure that elections run smoothly, in what could be his last radio appearance before his retirement in January, Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Kevin. Thanks for asking me, and I'm sure we'll have a lively discussion this morning.
I'm going to mix in a few personal anecdotes into this. I have not warned Jim Condos about this because he is retiring. His last day on the job is going to be January
5th.
And when I say Mr. Democracy, I'm not kidding. This guy, I remember him from my days in the State House, but long before that, he was on the South Burlington City Council. Were you in the House?
Never.
Yeah, you were a state senator from Chittenden County for how many years?
8 years.
8 years. And then you became Secretary of State. In fact, I think you were on the city council and the state senate at the same time. Is that true?
I was for part of it. I overlapped a little bit.
How did that go?
It was time-consuming. Let's put it that way.
I take my hat off to anybody who sits on a city council, a school board, or a zoning board. But it prepared you to do this job, which you've now held for
12 years.
12 years. First of all, before we get to the guts of this, tell us what – we had Sarah Copeland Hansis and Brooke Page on, the two candidates for your office, the other day, and they told us what they think this job is. What do you think this job is?
I like to say that the job is really about protection in a lot of ways. For instance, with the state archives, we protect our most precious documents. We help Vermonters, the media, access public records. So there's a protection of that cycle. In the corporations division, we actually receive from businesses that their annual reports, for nonprofits, biannual reports, their liens that they have. It's all public information. It's all available on our website. But we protect that information so that people have access, that the banks have. I can't tell you how many times I've heard banks or real estate agents tell us that I'm on your website all day long or whatever, because of the nature of the business that they do, that they're involved with. Of course, our Office of Professional Regulation, the single mission, people sometimes forget this, but the single mission is protection for the public. It is not about promoting the professions. And I think sometimes people get mixed up on that, and they think that we're going to be pushing and promoting the different professions. And we have over 50 professions and over 80,000 license holders that we deal with. But it's not. It's about protecting the public. And that's,
and these are the barbers, the cosmetologists, the
pharmacists, the veterinarians, yeah. Accountants, real estate, you name it. There's 50 professions that we oversee, and 80,000 license holders. And then, of course, elections. We're there to protect the integrity of our vote, to ensure that the process works. That's what I like to use, is that the word protection, because it crosses across the whole entire organization.
What has changed? I mean, when I was a younger reporter at the Burlington Free Press, the first call you always made when you encountered some free speech or public meetings difficulty, you called Jim Douglas, the Secretary of State. This office has had a long run of high-quality public servants. What's changed from the day you took this job to today?
So I think the biggest change is we went from a paper-driven office to a digital environment.
Yeah.
Literally in 2010, just before I took office, everything we did was done on paper. And, flash forward a few years, and we had moved to a digital environment, a website portal. And so you could file your registration for your business. It used to take 15 days for you to get the paperwork to be able to go to the bank with. Now it's done instantly or within 30 minutes.
Yeah.
When you file your registration papers, your annual report literally would take 10 to 12 weeks for us to it's a 3-month period, and it would take 10 to 12 weeks to follow up on all the processing of that. It's now done instantly, and it's filed and everything else. The liens, they're filed automatically, and everything is dated. We have tracking within the system so that we can see it. The same goes, and this you'll remember as a reporter, we did not have online campaign finance reports,
yeah,
or lobbyist disclosure reports. Right. Everything was done on paper, and we posted it, but it was posted as a PDF. So if you wanted to do something, you had to take that PDF, take the information off of it, get it into an Excel file so you could sort it and do things with it. Now it's done automatically. And, we were really proud of when we put the election management system in place. And just to give you an example of the quality of what we've done and how it's impacted the office, when I first took office in 2011, so my first election was 2012, my first general election that I oversaw. We were considered by the what is now called the MIT Election Performance Index. It was then run by the Pew Foundation. We were considered 38th in the nation. Our ranking was 38th at that time. By 2014, we had moved up to 16th in the nation, and then shortly after we put our system in place, our new electronic system, for election management, campaign finance, and lobbyist disclosure. We moved to number one in 2016, and we remain in number one in 2020.
And you must have spent, I don't mean this insulting, I would say this to myself too. You're not exactly a native digital guy.
I am not.
You
and I are the same.
Right? So you had to come into office and learn that.
Well, yeah.
And hire experts to help you.
I like to think my role is not to get too far in the details of what's going on. It's to understand the details.
Yeah.
But my role is to make sure I've got good people in the right positions to be able to lead us forward. And, you know, like I said, you know, we're now starting that second round of we're looking at a new corporation system pretty soon. We're going to be looking at a new election system because the 10-year contracts that we had set up originally are now coming due. So we have to start thinking ahead. And, you know, it's kind of like cybersecurity was never an issue for us. Although we had started, Vermont was ahead of the game back in 2012-13. We actually went out on our own without anybody pushing us to find out where are we positioned on cybersecurity. And when 2016 hit and the Russians attacked via cyber, and tried to meddle with our elections, we were already ahead of the game. But now cybersecurity is just another arm that we have to be involved with. And I like to say that cybersecurity is a race without a finish line. It's ongoing and will never end.
No kidding. So, Jim, the election is Tuesday, and yet a lot of people have voted already. You've been a champion of early voting and a champion of vote by mail. Tell us the numbers. Who's voted? Who do you think is, you know, how's this looking for Tuesday?
Well, it's looking like we're already surpassing 2018, which was the last midterm. In that cycle, we had total – we don't have full details, but we had total early votes of 72,000, and we're already at 145 this year.
Wow.
So – and that's 5 days out. I expect that 145,000 will continue to grow right up until Election Day. And, of course, a lot of people will be bringing their ballots back on Election Day as well. So, you know, those numbers will continue to climb. We had in the 2018 election 58% voter turnout. We should surpass that. But I do want to say that generally what happens in a presidential year, we're usually 65-70%. We were higher. We were almost 75% in 2020. But usually it's 65-70%. And in the midterms, it's usually 55-60%. So because the president's not on the ballot.
And what does this tell you, all this early voting? Is this to tell you that there's a healthier democracy, that people are motivated?
Well,
what conclusions can you draw?
I always say that our democracy is stronger and better with more people voting, and I firmly believe that. It's something that I think is kind of ingrained in me. I'm a second generation American. All four of my grandparents came here from Greece. They didn't speak any English when they got here. They all became citizens. They all started voting. My parents and their siblings were all born here in the United States.
Where did they arrive when they came from Greece?
Well, my grandparents came through Ellis Island.
Yep.
Your namesake.
I've been there.
So they stayed in the New York, New Jersey area.
Uh-huh.
I was actually born in New Jersey in 1951.
Where?
Orange, New Jersey.
Incredible. West Orange or East Orange?
I was born in Orange Memorial Hospital.
Oh, my God. Okay.
But we moved – my parents took my brother and I, and we moved to Vermont in 1955. They wanted to get away from the big city area, and they wanted to move – my uncle – had a restaurant or two up here, so my father was in the restaurant business. He managed my grandfather's diner, Greek diner, and we came to
– Where was that?
in Orange, right on Main Street in Orange. It was called the Moose Diner.
Incredible.
So, yeah, we came to Vermont in 1955. I was 4 years old. I've been here for 67 years now. No Never kidding. Left.
Wow. Okay. So back to the – so you're the believer in democracy, and these numbers are telling you something?
Well, I think people are interested, first of all. You know, and I think Kevin, I don't have to tell you anything about this, but you know, when you look at the races – you know, people – I get reporters asking me all the time, well, what's your prediction? I don't make predictions on the turnout because it's difficult to do.
Right.
But I always say preface by saying it depends on the number of races, which races, how competitive those races are, and anything else. You know, there might be local issues that are on about. Like in Burlington, we have a high school, a significant bond issue. So, you know, these things all tend to drive people for different reasons to the polls.
Yeah.
What my hope is that people will, you know, I always say, you know, your vote is your voice. Exercise it because I think that's important. That's the way our government works. We pick our representatives to serve us, whether it's at the local city council select board or in – you know, the state senate or the house or at statewide race.
I don't know why, but the phone board is lighting up. We got to take some calls.
Okay.
We haven't even gotten to the guts of what we want to talk about, but let's take a call from Fred in Newberry. Fred, you are on the line with Jim Condos, the Secretary of State.
Morning.
Morning.
Good hey, morning,
I
Fred.
I got a good one for you. It's really difficult to figure it out. But anyways, if I've heard on television, mostly it's liberal television, if the Republicans win the House and the Senate, our democracy is under attack. We could go into a fascist state. How do I figure that one out? How do you figure that one out?
That's a good question, Fred. Thank you for calling. Jim?
It's a good question, Fred, and I would say that it's above my pay grade. I mean, my responsibility is here in Vermont, and I think we're moving along just fine. But I think across the nation there are different situations. And I think the biggest thing that I think is throwing kind of a curveball out there is the people who are denying 2020 – was fair, free, fair, and correct, accurate. And I think that that's where you get some of that. And people who are saying, if I'm elected, I won't certify the election. Well, that doesn't work either. And I guess I would say from my standpoint, and a lot of folks know me, I've always run our office as a nonpartisan office, even though I run as a Democrat, but I do run the office in a nonpartisan way. And I, you know, I know that there are Republicans in the House and the Senate that would agree with that statement. But I think it is interesting from my standpoint to see what's going on around the country.
Fred, thanks for the call. Let's take another call from Sheila in Barry. Sheila, you're on the line with Jim Condos.
Yes, good morning. Secretary Condos, I do have a question that I think should be within your pay grade, and that has to do with these absentee early voting ballots that have been mailed out to all the registered voters. My question pertains particularly to what used to be the certificate envelope, which is now called the declaration. Under Title 17, is there anything in there that would allow someone other than the voter whose name appears on the certificate to be the one filling in their own name and signing it?
I don't know if you're referring. There was a situation that occurred where a husband and wife in the same address crossed up their envelopes, and one which has their name on the envelopes. If you were mailed an envelope, you got it from the initial mailing. Your name was listed on the internal envelope. And the question came up, what happens if the husband takes the wife's envelope and sends his ballot back in the wife's envelope or vice versa? And our advice to the town clerks was if they have proof that the two people live in the same household, then that should be good enough to accept both of those. Those are not defective ballots at that point. And we did put in place a defective ballot law this past year, which has worked very, very well. We're really pleased with it. Plus, we also worked with the Center for Civic Design, a national group that helps states prepare their envelopes and ballots to make sure they're readable, they're user friendly, and we think that that's also driven down the defective ballot.
Sheila, thank you for the call. We are in an era of election denial. I was on with, John Clark, running for Orange County Senate in Vermont. We had Brooke Page on, and I think, you know, when you ask them if Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States, they hem and they haw and they hedge, and I think that's a question that we've just got to keep asking of everyone so that everyone's on the record. Major Garrett, the CBS News correspondent who's on this program, talks about 305 candidates, according to CBS News, that are running and denying the Biden election. Why don't we get to some of those issues on the other side of the break? It's Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back.
You're glazed.
Yeah. Problem with getting Ellis and Kondos on the same radio show is they just, neither of us ever stop talking. It's, because talking about democracy is really fun, and it's an exercise that we all ought to be doing from now till Tuesday. Jim, is our election secure?
Yes.
Tell us.
Simply.
Tell us why.
So, back, there's a little bit of history here, but back in 2012, first of all, when I first took office, everything was done on paper. We had PDF files and all this stuff, but it was all done on paper. Since that time, we put a complete new election management system in place. We put campaign finance and lobbyist disclosure online, so it was no longer done on paper. And the whole thing that my whole belief, and as a former reporter, you know this, has always been that we should be operating in government as if there's 640,000 people in Vermont watching over our shoulders, that the public has a right to know, the public has a right to access, and the public has a right to attend. So those are the things that I believe strongly in, and then of course everything else kind of falls from there. And the issue of elections, going back to 2012 or 13, I came home from a national conference, because one of my colleagues, who is now the governor of Oregon, had said that her system had been breached. So I asked my IT manager, how are we set from a cyber posture? And he said, I think we're in really good shape, but we should probably go out and get an outside look at it. And we did. And we got back a report, and that report had a bunch of recommendations, high, medium, and low priorities, with some initial costs and or estimated cost, and we just followed that to a T. And by 2016, when the Russians attacked the U.S. Via cyber, we were really one of the best in the country. We still are one of the best in the country. We have all kinds of WAFs and different firewalls that we have in place. We work closely with, I was on the original election ISAC, which is infrastructure. ISAC, Infrastructure Security Analysis Center, at the federal level. Elections were named a public infrastructure and needed to be protected. I worked with Chris Krebs, who was the CISA director. And, you know, we put all the different things in place. We do annual penetration testing. We do all kinds of things to make sure that our cyber side is well protected. In 2018, August, my IT manager came to me and said that last night's log, he showed it to me, and there were several attempts by Russian entities trying to get into our system. I reported it to the Homeland Security and CISA. He reported it to the Center for Internet Security, and within 24 to 36 hours, a national alert went out to all secretaries of state to be on the alert for these particular IP addresses. Now, I get it. I'm not a nerd. I'm not a geek. So I don't have all the details of how this stuff works, but I know when it does work. And so it's been, you know, we are constantly working to improve. It's a never-ending battle, and it'll never change.
We have in front of us an editorial by Steve Pappas, the editor of the Rutland Herald and Barry Montpelier Times Argus, that says that the Associated Press has sent out a notice to all of its members saying to be on the lookout for disruptions, and that AP has a system in place to as a backup should there be any service disruptions, and they'll notify their newspaper editors, members, etc. If the Associated Press is preparing for possible disruptions, Russians, Chinese, Iranians, whatever, then you have layered upon that a national issue with, you know, you've got the gubernatorial candidate in Arizona, Carrie Lake, who's already said on the record, if I lose, it's stolen and I'm not going to give in. And that wave is happening throughout the country, and yet it does not seem to have penetrated Vermont, at least at the upper levels. There are fringe candidates that I see everywhere, thanks to the reporting of John Walters, who kind of tracks this. But for the most part, we're not seeing huge election denying going on here. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I would say that's probably a good summation of what's happening here on the ground in Vermont. I will remind you that post November election 2020, we had voicemail death threats.
Yep.
They were followed up again in October of 2021. You know, Reuters did a phenomenal job in writing that story up. Several different layers of it, and they know who that person is, and they're watching him. And I remember I was talking with one of the Department of Justice lawyers in D.C. Asking, you know, what's happening with this case, and he said, all I can tell you is that there was a team of FBI agents in full gear that showed up at his place where he's living, and he won't be a problem. That's what I was told.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I think it's just an ongoing issue. We all have to be vigilant. We just completed $30,000 worth of security upgrades to our building.
Yeah.
You know, our building, as you know, used to be open to the public during work hours. Now you have to ring a doorbell to get in, and there's a camera taking you, you know, looking at you so that whoever's going to answer the door can see who it is.
Here's an old reporter trick. It used to be that one of the fun parts of the job was you were in Montpelier, you just walk into the governor's office. You just walk into the fifth floor, take the elevator up, and see who you could bump into to interview. And those days are long gone, sadly.
They are.
Sadly. But we are going to take a call from Anita in Middlesex. Anita, you're on with Jim Condos. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jim. My name's Anita. First of all, I would like to thank you for your service and congrats on your future retirement. Jim, we have a peculiar connection. You said you were born at Orange Memorial Hospital in Orange, New Jersey. I happen to have graduated from there in the mid-60s. I don't think you were ready in Vermont, but I probably patronized your parents' diner. I just thought you need a little comic relief or a little personal relief.
But Anita, just to follow up on that, I was actually born in the 50s, early 50s, and we moved to Vermont in like in 1955, so I was here.
Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to add that to the repertoire, and thank you for the service.
Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you
right
for the call.
Bye.
That's great. Well, having been born in Neptune Memorial Hospital in New Jersey, I can sympathize with you northern New Jersey types. So there are mistakes that are made in elections. And I think what happens is the conspiracy theorists seize on a mistake here or a mistake there and blow it up. You know, I keep getting emails about this movie being made by Dinesh D'Souza about the mules that are, you know, secretly stuffing ballot boxes. That's been completely debunked. He is a convicted felon for funneling illegal campaign contributions, as I recall. So
and was then pardoned.
And then pardoned by former President Donald Trump, exactly. But there are mistakes that are made. So speak to that.
First of all, it's a human process.
Right.
And humans will make mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, we hear often that the tabulators are flipping votes or doing whatever, that they're already pre-programmed to have certain people win. There is no basis to that, and yet it continues out there. And, you know, to follow up, we actually do a post-election audit. It's a public process where we randomly select a certain number of towns. Those towns deliver their ballots to our office. We then do a completely different count process to verify that the numbers that were reported match the numbers that we're seeing from the ballots. I will say the total gold standard is that we have a paper ballot for every vote that's cast. So we do have that protection. The other thing is, and my former colleague, now retired, and Bill Gardner over in New Hampshire, would always used to say...
He's a Republican?
He was actually a Democrat.
He's a Democrat?
But he used to say, pick up a pencil and go, you can't hack a pencil.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, we don't use pencils anymore. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that it is a human process, and I will tell you that actually using scanners, which is what our tabulators are, is more accurate than the human eye. And good example, 2006 auditor's race between Randy Brock and Tom Salmon.
Randy Very
Brock,
close.
It was Randy Brock. After 250,000 ballots were cast, Randy Brock was up by, I think it was 140 votes. And Tom Salmon asked for a recount. After the recount, Tom Salmon won by about the same. What happened? So we looked at that. I wasn't in the office at the time, but they looked at that. And what they found were there were 15 hand-count towns that had put their results on the wrong line of the tally sheet.
Wow. Interesting. And who won? And Brock won that election.
No, Salmon.
Oh,
did.
Salmon won that election. That's right.
Brock was the incumbent.
That's right. Ziggy from Newport, you are on the line with Secretary of State Jim Condos. What's up? Hold on, we have there. We got her. We got him. Hey, Ziggy, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for letting me put in my 2 cents here. I just thought it was quite ironic on over the weekend. I happened to catch a video of President Biden voting in Wilmington, Delaware. Now, he was voting in person because Delaware does not have mail-in voting, which is quite ironic, I think. Plus, the thing that really brought a smile to my face was when he was reaching into his back pocket to pull out an ID. So they have voter ID. They have, of course, obviously they have early ballot voting, but it's in-person voting.
So, what's your question, Ziggy?
Well, no, okay. I do have a question for Jim. Jim, as far as the taking care of the voter logs, the rolls, is there any rules and regulations that come from Montpelier to the town clerks, or does each town clerk have their own system of doing that, clearing out? In other words, if somebody hasn't voted for 20 years, I mean, are they going to just be there for another 100 years, or how does that work?
That's a great question, Ziggy. And just to put it bluntly, first of all, we have federal laws that we have to follow. We have state laws that we have to follow. And yes, we do work. We do trainings with the clerks. We send out bulletins to them. The town clerk. The end result is that the BCA, the Board of Civil Authority, which is consists of the elected JPs and the elected legislative body plus the town clerk, are the ones that oversee everything, but that usually the town clerk is the one that handles the actual physical maintenance of that. The list that we have in Montpelier is made up of 247 checklists from around the state. We don't do the maintenance on the list itself as to who to add or who to delete. What we do is anything that we do, like if it comes through the automatic voter registration system through the DMV, we send that to each of the town clerks and say, here's your list of five or six people that it had, that are to be registered. And the clerk has to review it and then okay it to put it on their checklist. Our town clerks are probably some of the hardest, working municipal employees in the state of Vermont. And, they are, I always say this on election day, they're in their offices by 5 or 6 in the morning and they don't go home till after midnight. And it's just really, really, it's a manual process to a certain extent, but it's also, we rope in the digital process as well.
And with regard, thanks for the call to Ziggy. And with regard to checklists, it is a constant, battle, to keep those lists up to date. I hear often that there's dead people on the checklist. Well, yeah, but the issue is whether they vote or not. Is that right?
That is correct. And you know, I always say that, you know, dead people don't call us to tell us to take them off the checklist. The issue is that we receive the death records from Social Security and whatever through the health department, comes to us. We forward those on to the town clerks. They're responsible for removing dead people from the list. I will tell you right now, Kevin, every checklist in the country, every checklist in every state, county, or local election system will have dead people on it, because it's a catch-up issue, and we eventually catch up, but it doesn't always happen overnight. You know, here in Vermont, we have people who might go to the hospital in Dartmouth or Albany, New York, or Boston, Massachusetts, or if they're a snowbird, they might be in Florida or in Arizona. And if they die in those locations, it takes time for that record to get back to Vermont. So it's a never-ending battle. We have one person in our office who's solely responsible for maintaining the checklist, and they work with the town clerks.
Wow. Real democracy at work every day. It doesn't happen by accident.
No,
does it?
It doesn't.
Yeah. We're going to take another call. We have H. Brooke Page from Washington, Vermont, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State. Brooke, go ahead.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Secretary Condos. I heard my name invoked a little bit earlier as being in the basket of election deniers. And before I ask my question, I just wanted to point out that I should not be in that basket. Kevin, you and I discussed either on the air or off that.
Both, I think, on the air and off, as I recall.
Okay. I thoroughly recognize that Joe Biden is the duly elected and installed president of the United States. I know that for a fact because he got an overwhelming majority of the electoral votes in the Electoral College. You know, any questions that may come up should be always forward-looking, to look forward to the next election, not squabble over the previous activity. the things that have, are concern to me, and I think I've mentioned, is that the press seems to always have its thumb on the scale on one side or the other, that the that the riots that went on during the 2020 were a clear expression of some in the public that if the wrong person was reelected, that they would continue. And, you know, just a whole number of other things that tended to push the scales in one direction or the other. And that's all of a certainly a concern. But in the end, it's the numbers of ballots that are counted, hopefully all from legitimate voters. And those are then considered in selecting the electors to cast their votes. And in the end, Mr. Biden clearly was elected the President of the United States. My one before I ask my question, one other thing I haven't heard Secretary Condos say is it's very important at this late stage you do not mail your ballots in. You either take them in person to your town clerk's office or show up on election day and vote in person.
Oh, that okay. So, Brooke, that is a very helpful suggestion. So thank you for the call. Why don't you take that on, actually?
So, yes.
That's a great
actually,
question.
Brooke, we've been saying right along that if you don't get your ballot in the mail, in the Postal Service mail, by, we said, October 31st, which was this past Monday, then you should make other plans to get your ballots back. And that whole thing was about making sure that the ballots had time to get back to the town clerks. All the ballots that were mailed back have the town clerk's name and address on it. So if you received a ballot in the mail, your town clerk would be their name and address on that ballot envelope inside the envelope that is the what you put your ballot in. So yes, you're absolutely right. We've been saying right along. Really, when people talk about adding universal vote by mail and saying that really changes everything, what it does is provide another option for the voter. So they can return it by putting it in the mail, or they can deliver it by hand directly to a town clerk during their normal business hours, or they can drop it off at the secure drop box, or they can bring it to the polls on election day.
We're running out of time. Are we going to have a secure quality transition from you to the next holder of your office?
Absolutely. We've been working on our transition documents for the new Secretary of State right for months now and, you know, preparing for this time.
That's good. That's good to hear. Secretary of State Jim Condos, you're telling us that we've got a secure election, that people should vote, and that everything is going to be okay.
I would, as I always end these conversations, your vote is your voice. Exercise that option. This is how our government functions.
You know, I've told this audience many times that I used to be a reporter, and it was the Secretary of State's office that you could call, regardless of who was in the office, Republican or Democrat. I'm blanking on your predecessor, but
Markowitz,
Deb Markowitz, and you could get straight answers. And it's the place for democracy, and it's where the hard work of democracy gets done, whether it's the elections division, the regulation of barbers and cosmetologists, poll watchers, et cetera, communications with the town clerk. And it's just great that Vermont has a jewel of democracy in the Secretary of State's office, in part thanks to you. Enjoy retirement. Come back on the show as a private citizen.
I will do that.
Thank you, Secretary of State Jim Condos. Everybody vote. The election's on Tuesday. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis. You're listening to WDEV. We're back, and we welcome our Washington correspondent, Bob Ney, from D.C., with everything Washington, D.C., leading into the elections. But, Bob, let's start with the latest news out of Ukraine. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Well, the Ukrainians are, the Ukrainians are preparing. This is not really very good news, but they are preparing for a nuke hit. It's sort of like a, not, you know, will it happen, but when will it happen? A little bit of disparaging news. Now, who knows, you know, with Putin's mind, is he just doing this out there to try to get people afraid and maybe negotiate with him?
Yeah, that's right. And we awoke to the news this morning that weapons inspectors have confirmed that Ukraine is not in the process of making a so-called dirty bomb, as Putin has alleged. Obviously, that's posturing. And Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, is warning his people to please conserve energy because the bombing of Russian bombs have knocked out electricity. It is going to be a long, cold winter in Ukraine.
Right. And, you know, you make a really great point because the dirty bomb issue has been put out there by Russia. And they're saying, well, the Ukrainians are making a dirty bomb. So if anything happens, it's the Ukrainians. They're almost setting the stage for something to happen they can blame on the Ukrainians. And the fact that the, you know, the International Atomic Group has said that they really don't believe that to be credible just shows the fact that, you know, Russia will once again be lying. But, boy, this is lying about something that is really major. When you're talking nuclear, Putin is changing the world if he does this.
Clearly. Bob, also, President Biden made a nationwide speech this week talking about asking voters to save democracy from lies and violence. What's the reaction to that in D.C.?
Well, this is one of the most hard and difficult elections to predict that I've ever seen in 40-some years. It's just a moving target almost every day with the House and the Senate. And so there's a lot of last-minute factors coming in. If we look historically this year back at May and, of course, Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, and the Democrats had a definite leg up. People were angry. And then the economy kicked back into a problem with a lot of people in their minds. And gasoline went down a little bit, went back up. And the end result now is this is the polling where some polling shows that maybe if the president talks about a danger out here that people will relate that to the fact that they've got to keep the Democrats in control. I think, and at least in my opinion, having been around the business for a long time, one of the mistakes that they have made is having the president talk about MAGA people. Make America Great Again was a campaign mantra, of course, of Trump. That can include a lot of people who followed it. Doesn't mean that all the people that followed it were to the right of the right of the right. And so in their warning, they keep using MAGA, and I'm not sure that was the complete right tactic to use. They should have probably just stayed to the word extremist within the Trump movement. But so that's what the president's doing. Everybody's out here this weekend, and they're going to have their different spin on everything under the sun. So this is the president's.
Well, it's interesting. Right. It seems like the Democrats, in an effort to save themselves in the midterm elections, of ping-ponging between an economic message saying that the, you know, inflation is going to come down and gas prices are going to get better, to the abortion question, don't vote for Republicans because they're going to take away your reproductive rights, and now on to a message of saving democracy from the far right of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and one of the reasons the strategy changed, for example, in May or June, there were a group of women, and they keep going back to the same ones who are truly independent, their votes change, et cetera. They were 18% up in supporting Democrats. As of last week, they were 14% up in supporting Republicans. So it completely shifted. Now, these also were women who were very concerned about Roe v. Wade, you know, being overturned. So instantly, if you're in the political business on the Democrat side, you're going to say, uh-oh, the economy has surged back up to the number one, which it has. The economy is overriding everything. And, of course, economic reports are out today, which can be definitely analyzed different than the press spins today. But I think that's what happened. You know, the issues again, I've never seen issues become moving targets where they come in and then they kind of go away and a new one pops up. So on the strategy of both parties are trying to grab on to the last thing that's showing up in the polling.
Bob, let me ask you a question, which you'll be very familiar. If the Republicans take over the United States House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, the current leader of the Republicans, very much wants to be the Speaker of the House.
Right.
But when I talk to experts in the know, they often say to me, this is a case of the dog catching the car, and there's no way McCarthy's going to be Speaker because the right wing of the Republican Party, which is driving that caucus, they're going to look for somebody else who is more conservative than McCarthy. Take us inside the Republican caucus room about after the election if they take us over or take over the House.
Sure. I mean, I was there. I was one of the Contract with America class that we turned it over after 40 years and gave Republicans control. I watched Newt Gingrich become the hero of the day, and I watched Newt Gingrich quit as Speaker in a couple of years.
That's right.
And I know how that all happened. It took six people to say to him, I'm not supporting you, and he was gone. Now, McCarthy, who I actually hosted in Ohio years and years ago when he was a junior staffer for a California congressman, he's been active a long time. He's been around a long time. I'm going to predict that McCarthy, if the Republicans take control, because they may not, but if they do, McCarthy will be the Speaker. I'm going to predict that one out front. I'm going to disagree with a lot of the pundits.
And how does that work mechanically?
Right. Well, here's the deal. Somebody's going to challenge him, obviously. Probably Jim Jordan of Ohio. Not Marjorie Taylor Greene, but Jim Jordan of Ohio, probably. Somebody like that will challenge him. And then you have a private vote. Now, if these votes were ever public, the outcomes might be different, but they have a secret vote. Everybody sits in a room, but you literally write it on paper and they collect it. And I just think McCarthy, who has been, and the reason I say this, I'll give the rationale. I was on the Republican National Campaign Committee as a member of Congress. There was two of us, Phil English from Pennsylvania and myself. We dished out the money and we coordinated, you know, races. And I can tell you right now that McCarthy has had his fingers on that. You know, if they have a candidate, he's been in the district or he's communicated, he's sent money. And when the money comes from the National Republican Campaign Committee, it's really coming, you know, a lot from McCarthy because he's the minority leader, just like Pelosi on the Democratic side. You know, Tim Ryan, who's running in Ohio now for Senate, tried to knock Nancy Pelosi out, and he couldn't. And in this case, I think when they have the secret vote, first of all, the lieutenants of McCarthy, I call them lieutenants, members of Congress, who are the core support, maybe 10 of them, are going to go out, and they're going to individually target members, talk to them, and see, you know, what do they want? What's their needs? Quote, you know, do you want a piece of legislation next year? You need a fundraiser. This is the way the sausage is made in D.C.
Right.
I've been there. And then they're going to collect the votes for him. I'm not saying it's going to be a walk away, but McCarthy, I believe, will get enough votes out of that caucus because of new members also coming in. He'll become the Speaker if they take control. Now, I can make another prediction. Within 2 years, he'll be ready to pull his hair out.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
If in the time we have left, Bob, if you are sitting at home on Tuesday night watching CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, or ABC, NBC, CBS, what race are you watching closely to as a bellwether to tell you what's going to happen nationwide?
Right. I'll be calling into your station Tuesday night, and I'll be talking about the same thing. I'll tell you right now, for the Senate side, now the House is bigger. There's a lot of races to watch, you know, 35-some races. But on the Senate side, this is pretty simple. You know, it's going to be Oz and Fetterman in Pennsylvania, and then Walker and Warnock in Georgia. By the way, if Walker or Warnock, which is they're about 46.3 to 46.4 now each, if they don't, because there's a third party in there, a Libertarian, I think, if they don't get to 50% on election day, they have to run again December the 6th.
Right.
So we may not know the makeup of the Senate until that point in time. But I'm going to watch Georgia, and I'm going to watch Pennsylvania. Ohio, my home state, I don't know about it. I thought that Ryan would beat Vance, but right now Vance seems to be, you know, pulling ahead. And then I'm definitely going to watch Nevada.
Yeah,
no question about
that's
it. Right. Wisconsin also, but I believe Johnson will re-win up there. Yeah. But Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Georgia are big-time key states.
Well, we will be in studio. I'll be in studio with Mark Johnson waiting for your call. We'll be talking to you on election night, and we appreciate your calling in. Thank you very much, Bob Nay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we will be right back. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back. I'm Kevin. It's WDEV. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. Our guests this segment, Derek Brower and Courtney Lambden, intrepid reporters for 7 days, the great weekly in Burlington, and they have written a story this week that is complicated and important. It's called Warning Shots, and how the subhead is Burlington's immigrant community seeks solutions to the gun violence that is claiming our youth. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hi. Yeah, hi, Kevin.
Good to talk to you. So one of the great things about journalism is when you take a really difficult story and really unpack it. And I, why don't you, you've done this here. Before we get to the sort of the whys and the hows, tell us, give us the headline and tell us exactly what you wrote about in this story.
Sure, I can start us off here. As I think most people have heard by now, Burlington has seen an unprecedented surge in gunfire and shootings, really over the last 3 years. There have been more than 51 incidents in which police have logged guns going off in a criminal manner. There have been 4 homicides this year. But one thing that I think has been a little bit lost even in the discussion about the increased gun violence in the city is the extent to which this has been affecting and hurting and youth have been involved in these incidents. So one of the things we did was we looked at all of the available records for cases in which there have been arrests. We looked at victims and found kind of a startling number of these cases involving people who are under 21, even 18, and juveniles as well. And so this aspect of what Burlington is dealing with has not really been front and center, but there are folks, particularly in the city's immigrant community, which has been disproportionately affected by this gun violence, who are starting to organize around ways to address this problem of youth gun violence, which cities around the country, of course, have had for years, but is apparently just sort of coming into its own here in the Burlington area.
And Courtney, I noted that in the story that you report that political leaders, Moreau Weinberger, the police chief, others, were reluctant to talk about this as part of an issue being faced by the immigrant community for fear of exacerbating tensions in the community. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so they have really not discussed the people, the trends that we have noted as far as youth being involved and kids really from the immigrant community. When we asked the mayor and the police chief about this, you know, they said exactly what you just mentioned, that they didn't feel like it was particularly relevant to their investigations and didn't want to stereotype or stigmatize any group of people. But what that has meant for the, you know, public discussion around these events is that it's really been focused on kind of taking a tough on crime approach to the problem. They've formed the Burlington Police Department has become part of this gun violence task force that involves, you know, federal partners and other agencies. But there really hasn't been any public discussion about youth violence prevention. It's really been more about this is, you know, what we're doing. This is how we're going to arrest these people and hold them accountable. And so, yeah, that's really been missing from the public consciousness, which was one of the reasons really why we wanted to write the story.
There's a law enforcement component with this task force that's been that's being joined together by Burlington Police, South Burlington Police, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency. And then there's the social service piece. You talked to the head of the King Street Youth Center and a professor from UVM. I guess my question is, are the social service people talking to the law enforcement people who are talking to the school officials, or are they working in silos? Derek,
you know,
why don't you take the –
Yeah.
Courtney, go ahead.
No, Derek's got it. Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, it's a great question, Kevin, and I think I think the answer to it at the moment is that there has not been a convening of all of these different pieces to the puzzle to address this issue, either publicly or behind the scenes, really. But I think there is some interest in doing more of that, and the King Street Center's executive director, for instance, told us that that is one of her priorities, is trying to get every entity in the city whose work relates to youth together to start talking about this issue and coordinating response. But I think that has been what has been lacking somewhat so far is a coordinated response to this aspect of the gun violence problem.
Courtney, there's a quote from a UVM professor here that jumped out at me, among other things. Professor Mercedes Avila, a pediatrics professor who studies health disparities, she says, it's all connected to how disconnected, in a way, young people feel in our communities. Now, if that's not an indictment about the way we're doing things, all of us in our communities, I don't know what is. I don't know which one of you interviewed her, but that jumped out at me.
Yeah, we both interviewed Dr. Avila, and you know, she has a lot of hats. One of them is that she consults with law enforcement to have more of a culturally competent approach to dealing, you know, with interactions between police and immigrant communities. There's people that she works with who are called cultural brokers who try and essentially improve communication between the police and immigrant or non-English speaking, really, people. But yeah, what she was speaking to there is, I think, yeah, like you said, it really does make you ponder what are we doing for folks that come here that live on the margins? Are they resettled here and do they have enough support afterward? And so I think Dr. Avila was saying there that, you know, if youth are not feeling like they are part of the wider community, then there's a greater chance that they will become involved in activity like this. And so I think her statement there was sort of meant to be a call to action for people to begin thinking about that.
I mean, I'm old enough to – I mean, we've been saying this for generations. When children are left to their own devices, they're going to get in trouble. And that's why you need Little League. That's why you need STEM. That's why you need activities outside of school. And it sounds from your article like we are failing these kids. Now, you did make some discoveries on the positive side. LeVar Barino, the high school dean of students in Burlington High School, seems to be a bridge out there. Mello Grant. Talk about some of the positives. City Councilor Ali Deng is doing work in this area. Are there positives we can take out of your story?
Yeah, there certainly are. I think one of the dynamics here is that the police had known to some degree the shape of the problem here better than the public over the last 2 years while they were investigating the string of connected gunfire incidents involving young people. But it was really this summer when Hussein Mubarak, who was an immigrant from Somalia was shot and killed in the Old North End, that that the scope of the problem really became clear to everybody else, including City Councilor Ali Zhang, who told us he hadn't really understood the way this was affecting immigrant communities until that had happened. But in the wake of that, there has been some substantial organizing, I think, on the part of new American immigrant community leaders on several fronts. There is a group that had formed during the pandemic to address issues around culturally sensitive and accessibility issues around around vaccines and COVID-19 precautions. They have decided in the last few months to turn their attention to gun violence and received a $20,000 grant from the city to start conducting kind of initial outreach to immigrant communities to try to hear what they need, what's on their mind, and start to develop some recommendations from there. AALV, which has been in the Burlington community serving and supporting immigrant communities for a long time, is also in the process of convening a series of listening sessions with each ethnic group in the city that they serve over the next couple of months. So the wheels are turning here within the new American community. But in recent years as well, the school district has been thinking about these issues as well, particularly related issues around racial disparities and how people of color are disciplined in school and arrested, and youth of color are arrested at really extraordinarily high rates in Burlington. For instance, black kids make up just 16% of the student population in Burlington schools, but have accounted for 44% of youth arrests in the city. So there's really a lot of work to do there. But one of the ways they are deciding to tackle this is that they've hired LeVar Barino as the dean of students, who is experimenting with different approaches to try to get away from traditional school discipline modes like suspension, for instance, and instead trying to build trust with students who are at risk, trying to show them that telling a trusted adult when you have a conflict with somebody, another student, or you fear for your own safety, that is a helpful way to help resolve the issue. And he's been convening. One of the most interesting things I think he's been doing has been trying to convene students and families who are in disputes with each other to sit them all down in a room and try to hash things out so that they don't escalate on social media or in the street or after school.
Yeah. Well, it's a serious issue for serious people, and we're grateful for your article, Warning Shots, in this week's issue of 7 Days. Keep pushing. We need to hear this stuff, and it's the kind of journalism that a democracy needs. Thank you, Derek and Courtney. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back, and we are going to open the phones for the last segment of this show. We're on the verge of the midterm elections and the every 2 years election in Vermont. It's Friday. You've got Saturday, Sunday, Monday to think about it. And then Tuesday, you can go to the polls. If you haven't mailed your ballot, you can go to the polls on Tuesday. So much going on. Let's go around the landscape and try to make some predictions. But before that, let's do some housekeeping. I will be in the WDEV studios on Tuesday, analyzing the election returns. I'll be joined by former host of this show, Mark Johnson, and nobody's got a broader view and experience of the Vermont political landscape than Mark Johnson. He's been an editor, a reporter. He's been the host of this show for a long, long time. He's talked to everybody. He knows everybody, and he has a gift for analyzing elections. So, and with great insight. So he and I will be in studio. There's all sorts of other details. We'll have results for you, both nationally and local. I'm keeping my eye on several races in Vermont that are going to tell us a lot about the changing Vermont political landscape. And let's talk also about what's going on nationally and what to look for on election night when you're listening to WDEV. Before we do that, heck, let's take a call from Dave in Plainfield. Dave, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm glad to hear that you're having Mark on because he was on for many years, and I've done radio for many years in Plainfield under Greg Hooker. I've done many piano concerts, and Mark got to know me. He's really, really a lot different. He's really a very studious person. Okay, and get to know people that call in. It's like when I like to criticize them, but I don't do it on the air. But if somebody calls in, well, who are you? Where are you from? And you want to know something about the people. And everybody in this country is in such a darn hurry, including the sports people. You can barely get the football scores on Sunday. They go read them so fast. I'm like, what? Come on. But that's the problem. So Mark isn't like that. Mark got to know me. And I was really amazed at some of the stories I told him. I grew up in Yonkers. My family, I'm Ukrainian. I'm the first person. My family born in this country. And I've got all sorts of incredible stories that go on for hours and hours. And Mark got into some of this. I grew up in a lab. My father was a biochemist and all this sort of thing. But I called in about this issue. You know, I moved to Burlington in 74, and there was eight black people in the whole town. And there was two Puerto Ricans, and a Puerto Rican said it was so cold. You know, you can imagine one guy's father came up here and he said, you call this living? You call this life? I'm going to go back and sit on the beach. Why do you people live here? That's what this one Puerto Rican man said. That was in 74. And like I said, there's only eight black people in the whole town. And then the band that became Lamb's Bread, they came. And there's three brothers, the Hackney brothers. So we had 11 black people.
Dave, I'm gonna shut you off here. I really appreciate the call. And please call back. I'm going to try to stick to a bit of an agenda here. But you're a credit to the town of Plainfield, and we'll see you in Positive Pie there downtown someday for a slice of pizza. Let's go back. The local elections in Burlington are going to be important and bear watching. There are one of the ballot measures is whether or not they're going to build a new high school. As many listeners know, those kids have been going to school in what I affectionately call the Burlington Square Mall. It's kind of a windowless box, much of it below ground, because they discovered PCBs in the old Burlington High School. So the question was what to do. And you see street signs all over the town saying that we deserve a high school. Price tag, $160 million. It's pretty clear that price tag's going to grow, but there seems to be at least the visible support you see. It seems to be that there's a lot of people in favor of that. I mean, it seems like we're all in favor of Burlington having a high-quality high school. Question is the price tag, I think. So that we're going to be looking at that. We're going to be looking at the Chittenden Solid Waste District, which needs to build or says that it needs to build a materials recovery facility, also known as a MRF. And that's what takes your garbage in Chittenden County. And that machine separates the recyclables from the garbage and packs it up and sends it off to other markets to be resold and reused. That unit is the Chittenden Solid Waste people say that unit is on its last legs, needs to be replaced. I don't have the price tag of that in front of me, but it'll be interesting to see if voters go for both the high school and the MRF. The MRF's going to be on a separate ballot, I believe. In addition, Vermont voters are going to decide whether to amend the Constitution to enshrine reproductive rights in the Constitution. That's a hotly fought battle. The Planned Parenthood pro-constitutional amendment side of that equation has spent money running a campaign in favor of that. So has the other side, all using the predictable arguments, and we'll see if that passes. I'm keeping my eye on a Vermont Senate race. You know, as people know, the Vermont legislature is controlled by Democrats in an overwhelming fashion, both the House and the Senate. I'm going to guess here that the Vermont Senate is 23-7 off the top of my head. There is a race in Orange County where the longtime incumbent, Mark McDonald, is trying to hold on to that Senate seat in Orange County. He is being challenged by a Republican named John Klar, who has been on the show, in a mirror of what's going on in Pennsylvania, on the national stage. Mark McDonald recently suffered a stroke. He is recovering. He put that news out publicly, didn't shy away from it. And he says that he will be in fighting shape by the time the legislature reconvenes. Klar has been waging an aggressive battle. I just got an email from him just the other day talking about gas prices and inflation and bringing Vermont values back to the state. And so Klar's road signs are everywhere in Orange County. It's always a question about whether or not road signs reflect actual voting patterns. But one of the key things in that race that's happened is that when redistricting happened last year, when the legislature redrew the legislative maps, they took out of the Senate district represented by Senator McDonald, they took the town of Thetford, reliably blue and Democratic, out of that district. And they added the town of Bradford. And you would argue that the town of Bradford is a tad more conservative than the town of Thetford. And therefore, that opened the door for a Republican like John Klar to possibly win that election. So it will not tilt the balance of power in the Vermont Senate, but it would add a conservative voice to the Vermont Senate that it does not have at the moment. Most of the Republicans, I'm going down the list in my head right now, you'd call them traditional Republicans. They're Randy Brock from Franklin County. They're across the aisle Republicans. Klar, I think, is a bit more conservative, and it would be fascinating to see how the dynamic of the Vermont Senate changes with a guy like Klar in attendance every day. We welcome your calls, 244-1777, and we will. I see the call board is lighting up, but we will take that call on the other side of this break. It's Vermont Viewpoint, and you're listening to WDEV. We're back. It's Kevin Ellis, Vermont Viewpoint, WDEV, place for politics for the next few days until the election. By the way, future shows include Elon Musk and Twitter. I guarantee you we're going to have a show on that. I'm just trying to find the right guest who can separate the wheat from the chaff or the junk from the truth about what's going on at Twitter with its new owner, who's firing the management team, firing the board, and firing a bunch of the employees. I read this morning that its biggest advertisers are pulling their ads, or at least putting them on pause. So there's a lot going on at Twitter, which doesn't affect most of us, But what it does do is give us a window into the world of Elon Musk, who is now making a lot of our cars, is making spaceships to go to outer space. He makes a lot of solar panels that are going on our roofs, and he's a big player in our economy. And therefore, where he goes is going to be a little bit of where our technology goes, and as technology increasingly drives our society, we're going to have to keep an eye on that. We will do a show on the elections. We'll wrap those up. We will also do, depending on what happens with the elections, election denialism and the political violence that's going on with the break-in at Speaker Pelosi's house and the fractured skull of her husband. He's still recovering. This kind of violence has been a part of American life for a long time. It's clearly being fueled by lots of factors. We're going to focus in on that. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it responsibly, and we're going to have experts on the show to tell us where this came from and where it's going, because it has its impact on democracy. You could see in our conversation with Jim Condos, the Secretary of State's office. You know, you're forced to talk about this stuff. And when you've got you've got candidates out there that when they lose an election that will deny that they lost and blame it on, conspiracies, it's an issue we're going to have to talk about. We will also try to talk about the situation with the transgendered, student in Randolph. We're going to invite the superintendent of schools on the show to talk about that. These are yet again a delicate issue that has to be talked about responsibly, and we promise to do so. With that, let's go to the phones and talk to Joanne in Williston. Joanne, you're on the line. How are you?
Well, thank you. Such an interesting program.
Thank you.
If Article 22, the reproductive part, is passed by Vermonters, no pro-life doctor or pro-life nurse will be guaranteed their job. And no school of nursing or medical school will be able to admit a pro-life student. There will be such a lack of nurses and doctors in Vermont. I would just beg that Vermonters think through the ramifications of this. So thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. Let me see if I have that right. Joanne, you're a little bit above my pay grade there. I haven't studied this issue in depth. I have a lot of generalized political experience with the reproductive rights issue. So what you are saying is that if this reproductive rights amendment, and I would invite Lucy LaRiche or anybody from the Planned Parenthood side of this, if they're listening, to please call us at 244-1777 or anybody else who wants to comment on this. What I heard you say was that if the reproductive rights amendment passes, that no pro-life nurse or doctor is going to be able to practice in Vermont. And I think part of your involved in that question is the assumption that when anybody applies for a job in Vermont, their employer is going to ask them whether they are pro-life or pro-choice or whatever terminology you want to use. And I'm not sure that is the case. But again, I welcome anybody to call in and discuss this. It is a little bit above my pay grade. I'm no lawyer and no expert on that reproductive rights amendment. So I'm going to stop there because I don't want to mislead anybody. That battle has been joined. I've been part of those battles. I was part of the same-sex marriage battle in this state for 10, 12 years. And boy, that was emotional. This one is as well. Constitutional amendment means that, it only passes after and goes to the voters as it is now after it's passed the Vermont General Assembly on two occasions, which this has done. So the Vermont legislature has approved this, and now it is in front of the voters right now by mail, and on Tuesday you'll have a chance to cast your ballot on that. So again, it's pretty clear that the Vermont legislature is going to stay in strong Democratic hands, but there are races out there, and we were talking about the Orange County Senate race with John Clark challenging Mark McDonald. I've said several times on this show, I used to live in Orange County, and McDonald's was an inveterate campaigner showing up at virtually every Little League game and public event. And he is now slowed down a bit by this stroke. And John Clark's an aggressive campaigner. So we'll see what happens there. And see whether if Clark were to win that race, whether that changes the tone or the vibe or the makeup of the Vermont Senate. Speaking of the Vermont Senate, so let's go down the line here. Governor Phil Scott's running against Brenda Siegel, a spirited challenger. They've debated several times. We'll see what happens there. There is a feel out there, I think, just anecdotally, that Brenda Siegel has with her take no prisoners approach, and a great roadside, I must say, gotten under the governor's skin a bit, but there's no denying that the governor is immensely popular in this state. It is difficult, as Howard Dean discovered, as Jim Douglas discovered, as Madeline Cunin discovered. Running for a fourth term is not easy. This is a really hard job. It's tiring. And you see a lot of the same issues coming around and around and around. And eventually, as I don't know whether it was Jim Douglas or Howard Dean, probably both from different parties, said, after a while, the voters get tired of you. They get tired of hearing your voice on the radio, on TV. And in Governor Scott's case with COVID, they heard from him every day for quite some time. So the lieutenant governor's race, that's an interesting one as well. David Zuckerman running to retake that seat and being challenged by State Senator Joe Benning, he of Lindenville and Harley-Davidson Motorcycles. Joe, call in if I have the make of your motorcycle wrong. Or my other host, Pat McDonald, will get me because she's a motorcycle rider too. And Becca Ballant, the president of the Vermont Senate, poised to become the first female member of Congress from the state of Vermont, indeed making history. And that'll be a fun race to watch, and it'll be a fun victory in all likelihood, a victory party for Ballant because her opponent, the Republican Liam Madden, who I've had on the show, is mired in a election finance controversy of his own making. And if Ballant leaves, that means that there'll be a new president of the Vermont Senate, and that bears watching as well. Lastly, I will be in the DEV studios on election night with Mark Johnson analyzing election results. Be sure to join us. It's the best place to be for returns, both national and local. That's our show for today. You can find us at Vermont Viewpoint at RadioVermont.com or at WDEVRadio.com. Remember that the show becomes a podcast, something that sometimes that very day, so you get the whole show on your own time. Thanks to digital guru Stephen Tanzi for that, and thanks to Director Danny at the soundboard for making the show run smooth. You can find me on Twitter at Ellis52K, where I discuss many of these same issues, and also at my blog newsletter, Conflict of Interest, at KevinKEllis.com. Click the subscribe button. You'll get it free. And I'll be back Monday with a full discussion about election politics and a surprise guest about who's written a book about the tennis great Roger Federer at 10 o'clock on Monday. We'll do predictions and analysis, and we'll be in studio for political analysis on election night. That's the show. We'll see you on Monday. You're listening to WDEV.